We have a few loose ends to gather up from last time. So let us briefly recall filtrations, right? Did you call closure of alpha capital sigma, or did you just call it closure of alpha?
Only closure of alpha.
Only closure of alpha. So. So let's recall the definition. We take a formula alpha, and M a model, how did we call valuations, pi or?
Pi,
yes. A model with these data, set to W of worlds, transition relation R, valuation pi. And there was a definition of what it meant to filter M by alpha, and the filtration of M by alpha would not be uniquely defined, but it would be a relation, an equivalence relation on the set of worlds, and the equivalence relation on the set of worlds is defined by alpha, but the relation that we get on the corresponding quotiented model is only axiomatized within a certain range. So we have this, did you give the equivalence relation a name? Induced by alpha?
I just wrote subscript alpha. So I wrote it. No, I didn't the name equivalence relation.
Okay, so let's say that V is alpha equivalent to W. If and only if for all formulas phi in the closure of alpha. If and only if V satisfies phi, if and only if W satisfies phi, so two states in the model are equivalent if and only if are indistinguishable by subformulas of alpha. And then a relation on the quotiented set, quotiented by this indistinguishability relation under alpha, is a filtration if and only if the following hold. So let me remember, there's two conditions basically. I shouldn't call this R as well, I should call this R bar. So, first of all, it has at least a minimal prescribed size, this relation. Namely, whenever I have WRV upstairs in the original model, then I also want it downstairs where, well, I'm omitting the triple equality sign on the index here. So by writing index alpha here, I mean equivalence classes under this equivalence relation here. So whenever I have a transition upstairs, it survives downstairs. So that's the minimal relation that I have, basically. And second, there's basically a condition that bounds the size of R bar from above. And it says that whenever I put two equivalence classes in relation R bar, then this must be compatible with the satisfaction of modal formulas when restricted to the closure of alpha. So that means, well, let's write this in terms of boxes. For all formulas, no, not sigma, phi, box phi, in the closure of alpha, so we strictly mean here that the box should be there as well, so the whole formula box phi should be a subformula of alpha. If W satisfies, so the original W in the original model, if W satisfies box phi, then V satisfies phi. So there's so this definition was there last time. So as Tadeusz noticed afterwards, well, not that he could have done anything against it because the time was up. There was three things missing. First of all, we have to show that we really do have a minimal and a maximal filtration where we define R bar by precisely either the first condition or the second condition, meaning that if we define it by the first condition, then the second is automatic and the other way around. And second, we have to still have to prove and even state what this whole business with filtrations is actually about, namely that satisfaction of formulas survives in the filtered model.
Only
of course, subformulas of alpha. So let's prove these three things. State them as lemmas, or give them names. So, first lemma about the minimal filtration. So, I keep all the notation and I just keep using the same symbols. So if we define R bar by this condition here inductively, basically, so as the smallest relation that satisfies this condition here, condition one, that is, we define R bar as the set of all pairs of equivalence classes, class of W, class of V, where the pair V comma W, sorry, W comma V is in R. Then, defining it this way, then our bar is actually a filtration. That is, it satisfies also condition two, and it is the least filtration. Well, this thing in brackets is clear because it's clear that any filtration by dint of condition one will have to contain this R bar here.
Maybe it makes sense to add some kind of subscript related to.
Do we really want to? Yeah, min, maybe, yeah. Well, okay, so if we're giving out names, then we can just as well state the second lemma just behind us before we proceed with the proofs, so we have both of the statements at hand. Minimal isn't very good, right?
Least, or sometimes finest.
Finest.
I've seen it being used, but least is probably the best.
Yeah. Yeah, right. A fine relation is one. I was wondering about fine and coarse, but yes, a fine relation is one that doesn't put a lot of things in relation. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, let's stick to least and the. Greatest filtration, correspondingly, is defined by the second condition. So, that means we decree that two equivalence classes are in relation R bar max for distinction if and only if the condition in number two holds. So, for all box phi in the closure of alpha, that is, for all subformulas of alpha that have the form box phi, if W satisfies box phi, then V satisfies phi. Okay, and the statement of the lemma is, then R bar max is the greatest filtration. So now we have two claims to prove. We start off with the one about the least filtration. Okay, so basically we have constructed R bar in such a way that condition one is satisfied, just barely, basically. And we have to show that condition two is satisfied, so. We take a pair of worlds that is in relation upstairs, then it's also in relation downstairs. Or basically, this here is equivalent to the pair being in well. Wow, careful. Okay, I could have continued here, but that would have been slightly unreadable. So, let's be very slow here. Let's take two things that are in relation down steps. So let's start this way. In this minimal one. Okay, so now there's a stumbling block here, right? We could now jump to the conclusion that this here means that W is in relation R to V. But that is not true. So the way we find R min tells us that these two things are the equivalence classes of some worlds that are in relation upstairs, but it's not clear that these worlds are going to be the ones that I wrote here. The only thing I know is that there are worlds that are in relation which are equivalent to these worlds, right? So, we have some W prime that is equivalent with respect to subformulas of alpha to W, and the same for V, say V prime. Such that W prime is in relation R to V prime. Now I have to prove this universally quantified implication here. So I take some box phi in the closure of alpha, and I assume that my original W satisfies box phi. Now, I cannot as yet conclude anything about V because W might not be in relation R to V. But what I know is that W is alpha equivalent to W prime, and that this thing here is in the closure of alpha. So, because W is alpha equivalent to W prime, it follows that W prime satisfies box phi. Notice how it is important that we require that box phi is actually a subformula of alpha and not just phi. Now, of course, because W prime is in relation R to V prime, we can just apply the semantics and obtain that V prime satisfies phi. And now, backwards, we know that V is alpha equivalent to V prime, and therefore V satisfies phi. So, that was the bit about the least filtration. Now, let's check the one for the largest. I think that's actually easier, so it should still fit on this part of the blackboard. Okay. So for the greatest filtration, we have to now to prove that it satisfies item one. So we now give ourselves a pair W and V that's in relation upstairs, and we have to show that it's in relation downstairs under our relation R bar max. Okay, but R bar max has a definition which is still up there, so this is this universally quantified implication, so we have to show that this holds for these two guys. So, that means we give ourselves a box phi satisfied by W, right? So a box phi which is in the closure of alpha and which is satisfied by W. Now this time we know that W is in relation R to V, much easier. So it follows that V satisfies phi because, well, because W is in relation R to V. And yeah, that's already it. Okay, so that's the least and the greatest filtration. And like I said, there remains a third thing to be discharged. Graphics.
Maybe it is also worth mentioning that, of course, all this definition could be stated in a bit more generally, when instead of having closure of a single formula alpha, you could take any finite set of formulas closed under subformulas. And this is actually what we attempted to do all the time. This is also why it was trying to write sigma.
Yeah.
Because this is what you see in all the references. I just took a quick look at the last lecture. But
yeah, which is the right decision given that we're trying to cover modal logic in 5 sessions, right?
So.
So the last lemma again receives a name. We're just going to call it the filtration lemma because this is the key property of filtration, but it doesn't deserve the name theorem, so it's just a lemma. So it states that satisfaction of formulas survives the filtration, but of course only those formulas that are in the closure of alpha. So that means some state W in the original model satisfies phi if and only if its equivalence class under alpha in the filtered model satisfies phi. Provided, of course, I'm reiterating this now. I shouldn't have to because I'm keeping all the notation, of course, including the notation for R bar and the assumption that it's a filtration. But of course, in order to emphasize again why this is the filtration lemma, well, we're assuming that R bar, the relation on the filtered model, is a filtration, and under this condition, this equivalence here holds.
Lutz is for convenience dropping a model in notation for satisfaction, so maybe it's well restating that we have a valuation as
oh, right, I forgot to repeat the bit about the valuation. Tadeusz did say this last time, so the valuation on the filtered model is defined unambiguously as. Let's give this a bar as well, so pi bar of. No, not V, but say A. Is the set of all equivalence classes
alpha.
Such that W is in pi of alpha
of
A, not of alpha. Yeah, thank you. recall that, well, this here makes the extension of the propositional atoms quite large as far as these propositional atoms are outside alpha, but as soon as these propositional atoms here actually appear in alpha, nothing really happens here because I only identify such worlds here that have the same behavior with respect to the valuation of those atoms anyway. Right, so yeah, that is the recap of the definition of the valuation.
Yesterday I was writing S for what is now R bar and rho for what is P bar, but probably this is better notation, so
right.
You can just mark it.
Okay, so let's make the correspondence. So apparently the notation was different last time. Okay. Right. Okay, it remains to prove this statement here. So the way we prove this is by induction, right? Induction over phi. And well, because we want to use induction over phi, we now understand why we had to define the set of formulas that we're interested in as being closed under subformulas. Because in the course of the induction, we're going to keep reducing claims to subformulas. And of course, if we want to apply this induction hypothesis here, then it better keep applying to subformulas whenever we make a transition to a subformula. So that's why we formed originally the closure of alpha under subformulas. So induction over phi, and this induction goes as these inductions always go. So the Boolean cases are trivial. So I'll just do the one for bottom. If phi is bottom, then both sides of this equivalence, or this claimed equivalence, are clearly equivalent because they're both false. And so the cases for negation and conjunction are marginally more intelligent because they actually use the inductive assumptions, but they do so in a very trivial way, right? So there's one moderately interesting case, that's the one where phi is an atom. So I'll just designate the cases by writing the formula that I'm considering. Well, W satisfies A. If and only if W is in pi of A. And now this step is worth thinking about briefly, and in fact, I've been waffling about this step just a minute ago. So by the definition of pi bar, I would only get the implication from right to left. From left to right. So as soon as W is in pi of A, by this definition here, the equivalence class of W will be in pi bar of A. But because A is in the closure of alpha, the reverse holds as well. Okay, now this, of course, is then equivalent to the class of W satisfying the atom A. And the actual interesting case, of course, is the one for the box. Do I want to split this? Yeah, I want to split this. So let's split this into two implications. So we first assume that W upstairs satisfies box phi. And now we want to prove that the equivalence class of W satisfies box phi downstairs. So we have to assume that we have a transition downstairs into some other equivalence class for V. So we assume we have an R bar transition from the equivalence class of W to that of V. Now, by condition 2, in the definition of filtration, these two things together will imply that V satisfies phi. And now comes the induction to phi. We can apply the induction hypothesis. So now it follows that the class of V satisfies phi downstairs. So that's what we had to prove, right? So basically now we have effectively shown that the class of W satisfies box phi downstairs. Right. Converse implication. So now, we assume that the class of W satisfies box phi downstairs. And now we have to verify that W satisfies box phi upstairs, so we have to show that all R successors of W, say V, satisfy phi. And now the other condition in the definition of filtration comes into play. So if W is in relation R to V, then we must have the same relation downstairs for the equivalence classes. So by condition one, we have that the class of W under alpha is in relation R bar to the class of V. But we already know that the class of W satisfies box phi, so the class of V satisfies phi. And now the induction hypothesis applies because we already know the claim is true for phi. So it follows that V satisfies phi upstairs. And now we've shown for arbitrary V that is a successor of W that V satisfies phi. So W satisfies box phi. Okay. You're not content.
Could the first direction, how do you know that there is this to be?
I don't have to. I mean, if there exists none, then all the easier, then I go home. I have to show that for all V such that the class of V is in relation R bar to that of W, the class of V satisfies phi. If there are no successors for which I have to show this, then all the better.
This is something we have already discussed, right? That every formula prefixed with box is true at any point which has no successor.
Even box false, yeah. So there may be situations where false is necessarily true. Yeah, actually we discussed this in the beginning, right? It's one of the central problems of deontic, well, central is a matter of taste, but it's one of the much discussed problems in deontic logic. That there shouldn't be situations where, I mean, that in deontic logic, you precisely don't want this. You precisely do not want O of bottom. It should not be, you should not be obliged to do something that is logically impossible. And, yeah, so there's various tricks that you try to subject deontic logic to, and basically you do weird tweaks to its semantics that ensure that this won't happen. Okay, this is maybe the point to mention that there is a new exercise sheet online due in two weeks. I should maybe show it to you. Now, where did this go? It was here just a moment ago. There. Ha. There we are. Okay. So here for everyone to see, let's switch off the blackboard lighting. Okay, due date 24th. You will note, if you follow closely, that the sheet has 25 points compared to the 20 that were on the previous sheet. That is, well, partly an accident of what, basically due to the number of exercises that we're able to think of. So it's just that we're able to think of lots of modal logic exercises, and we're loath to let go of any of them. So we already kicked out one or two, but then we stopped kicking things out. So there's five exercises on the sheet, 5 points each. I considered downgrading them to 4 points each, but then I figured, what the hell? I mean, it's also more work than the last one, and we want it to be more work than the last one because this course is about non-classical logics, such as modal logic, and not about classical propositional logic. So it's only fair that the sheet about classical propositional logic counts less than this one. It still should be doable, I guess, within 2 weeks' time. So. There's a lot of text on the sheet, but that's just today-ish being conversational, so you don't have to worry about it most of the time. So these asides really are asides. I mean, you can read them to have fun, and they're good to know, but they don't have to be fully understood in order to solve the exercise. So here we have the first exercise, which is about frame correspondence. So today-ish has been talking about these frame axioms, some of which you see here. So you have to remember what these frame axioms mean if you're given only a frame. So this means that if that these axioms are true on the frame no matter what the valuation of P is. So the valuation of P can be chosen freely as any subset of the set of states. And it, basically the exercise asks you to prove that these well-known conditions here on the frame, say reflexivity of the transition relation, transitivity, symmetry, that they're actually equivalent to validity of these axioms, which is one of the really cool things about modal logic. You can express, well, okay, it's not really quite true to say that these are complicated formulas, but you really can phrase them quite succinctly as cool modal formulas that on top of that correspond to natural properties that you would expect the box operator to have if you read it as necessarily, right? At least the first two. So the first one reads that if P is necessarily true, then P is actually true. And the second one reads that if P is necessarily true, then P is necessarily true. So it basically says that necessity cannot be contingent. Well, the last one's a bit, and I'm not sure I can read this, right? And it says that if P is true, then P is necessarily possibly true. So basically, nothing can be true in the current world that is necessarily impossible, right? I mean, or that is possibly impossible. So that all these are quite reasonable properties that you would expect a necessity operator to have, right? So and then there's you have to actually prove these, and so there are always two implications to prove. Of course, you have to prove that if the frame is reflexive, then the property holds. There, of course, you have to assume that P is interpreted arbitrarily. You don't know anything about P. You still have to prove that the axiom holds. So all of them are implications. So you assume that the left-hand side is true, and you show that the right-hand side holds. So that's fairly easy. The converse direction requires a tiny bit of creativity, because basically you're given that these axioms are valid no matter how you interpret P. And you will get these properties on the left-hand side given the data on the left-hand side of the arrow typically. So you assume you already have x, y, z, such that x is in relation r to y and y is in relation to z, and then you pick your p. And you have to do it in a cunning way to ensure that you actually get this relation x, r, z out of it.
We did it from QCLS with the example of density.
Right, yeah, so this has been done for, right, thanks. This has been done for density, which is actually the opposite implication of this one here. So if something is necessarily true, then it is necessarily true. And so you can basically find some orientation in that proof.
I just noticed that if I should have written it validates the formula in the right column, or that the formula in the right column holds, satisfies it, maybe I'm misreading, like
that. Yeah, well, actually, I wrote satisfies there, right? I mean, So of course, this is a notion of frame satisfaction. A frame satisfies a formula that contains a propositional atom if all the Kripke models I can base on that frame satisfy the formula, right? And of course, a Kripke model satisfies a formula if all its states satisfy the formula. So there's a lot of quantifiers in here, right? So there's one quantifier over all Kripke models that I can put on a Kripke frame, that is all the valuations for the propositional atoms. And then there's a universal quantifier over all the states in the model, right? So that's what it means for a frame to satisfy a formula. Okay, any questions about this one? Okay, you're welcome to ask questions about the exercises at any point, notarily, right? I mean, just ask us in the lecture or send email or whatever. Okay, so exercise two, you're not able to do yet because I still have to introduce the sequence system, which I'm going to do today and tomorrow. So exercise three you can already do. It doesn't require any particular techniques, it's just an observation. So basically, have we shown that K has the finite model property? It is a direct corollary of the filtration lemma, right? So the filtration lemma says that if I'm given any model of some formula, then I can turn it into a finite one by applying the filtration. So then maybe we should write this as a corollary explicitly here, right? So this is immediate from this lemma. K has the finite model property. Right, again, given any model, some finite model property means any satisfiable formula is satisfiable in a finite model. And, right, so maybe you should write this down explicitly before we get lost. Where are we? There. So basically, I'll just write this down for eternity. What does it mean for a logic to have the finite model property? Well, the finite model property states that if phi is satisfiable at all, then phi has a finite model. And like I said, so the fact that the modal logic K has the finite model property is immediate from this lemma, namely, given any model of, say, alpha, I mean, for some reason the formula is called alpha in the lemma, given any model of alpha, we just filter by the closure of alpha, we obtain a finite model because there's only finitely many equivalence classes under this equivalence relation induced by alpha. And the lemma says that the filtered model, which is finite, still satisfies the same subformulas of alpha that the original model satisfies. In particular, there's a point in it that satisfies alpha itself. So the lemma immediately implies that K is the finite model property. So that we've seen, and we've seen that it has the tree model property. This is something that Tadeusz used using, proved using by simulations. Is that true?
Unraveling.
Yeah, unraveling, right? And so it happens to be true that K also has the finite tree property. That is something that will actually fall out of the completeness proof of the sequence system that we're going to introduce later.
So we're
not skipping it. We have not discussed in detail, but we will discuss it actually. Well, and given that the sheet assumes that you are able to do sequence style proofs, it will actually assume that you've seen that proof. So the proof that is actually a separate one. So you cannot conclude from the fact that K has the tree model property and the finite model property that K has the finite tree model property, because the trees that we construct in the unraveling method are very much not finite, right? They're infinite unravelings. And the finite models that we construct here in the filtration, they are very much not tree. They are big clumps, right, that have cycles and whatnot. And here we show that indeed there are logics for which this combination goes wrong. So it says here that we have shown that S4 has the finite model property. Well, we haven't shown this yet, but you're asked to prove it further down.
Oh.
Well, actually, S4. It says transitive. It should say transitive reflexive, actually, because it's S4, right? Not K4.
Yeah, but the reflexivity always falls for.
Yeah, right. That's true. So,
I mean, if you play the
reflexive model, then you retain reflexivity, yes. And that actually has been mentioned, yeah. Okay, so that's one thing. We have S4 has the finite model property, and we will see later that there's a typo here, right? It says finite model property and finite tree property. That's supposed to say tree property, right?
Oh, yes, it's a typo.
So Tadeusz has also shown that that's actually a real typo, so that's a bit confusing maybe. Well, I'll change it later. So the finite tree property in brackets is supposed to be just tree property. Otherwise, of course, the whole exercise would be blatantly inconsistent, right? So Tadeusz has shown that S4 has the tree model property, again by infinite unraveling. But S4 does not have the finite tree property. And that's what you're asked to do in this exercise and the next one, and well, actually the one after that belongs here as well, as we've seen. So basically, this here's a fairly moderate exercise because it just asks you to show soundness of an axiom, basically. It asks you to show that a particular formula here, which is called the McKinsey formula, is valid on every finite partially ordered set. Okay, so partially ordered, does everybody remember what a partially ordered set is? Well, if not, then it's actually explained in the exercise. So it's a set equipped with a relation that is reflexive, transitive, and anti-symmetric, where anti-symmetric means if two elements are mutually in relation, then they're already equal. Okay, so basically you have to show that this is valid on finite partial order. So this is in boldface for a reason. So you really need to use that it's finite. And there's a hint here that asks you to think of an order theoretic property that distinguishes finite post sets from infinite ones, whereas the leading example of infinite ones, natural numbers with a standard ordering are named. Well, it's not maybe such a standard example, but it's one that illustrates the property that infinite partial orders in general don't have. Okay. I would have to guess myself at the moment. I think I'm. One should actually not leave the guys guessing what this property is. So, if finite partial orders have maximal elements.
And, it's trivial,
well, no, it's a, I don't think. No, the hint doesn't make it trivial. So, right. So everybody know what a maximal element is because I'm. Yeah, everybody happy with that? Okay. So, in particular, with the fact that maximal elements and greatest elements are not the same notion. So. Here's a partial order. It has two maximal elements, but no greatest element, right? Yeah. So let's take a partially ordered set x, comma, less than or equal. Then an element of X is a greatest element of X if and only if for all y is less than or equal to X. And such an element does not exist here because these two elements are incomparable, right? So this one here is not a greatest element because it's not above this one and the other way around. So no greatest element in this set. On the other hand, we say that X is maximal if and only if nothing is properly above X. That is, for all Y, if X is under Y, or if Y is above X, then Y is actually equal to X. Well, given that we already know that it's above X, that can be phrased as just saying that Y is below X. Right, so that's a maximal element, and yeah, that says that these two guys are maximal elements, right? So there's nothing that is properly above this one, and there's nothing that's properly above this one. And you can already see here, right, that a finite, well, obviously, if I draw a poset on the board, a finite one, then I'll have reached the top of the board at some point, right? And there will be something that is maximal in the sense that nothing's above it. So any finite poset has maximal elements. It may not have a greatest element, but it will always have maximal elements. And moreover, every element is below a maximal element.
Actually, we have not discussed it. Do we want students also to prove that every element is below a maximal element, or can we?
Nah, this is not a course on order theory. I mean, you can assume the evident property for, I mean, you can say that it's evident, right, that in a finite partial order, every element is below a maximal one. And yes, one can formally prove this by induction on the size of the partial order, but that doesn't really pertain to the course, I would say. So. Then there's something about proof search in S4, again, which you cannot do yet because I haven't shown you how to do sequent proofs in S4. And the formula which you're asked to not prove is the same formula as appears in the previous exercise, so the McKinsey formula. So this formula is, we claim, not valid in S4. And, well, that will just turn out mechanically by conducting a proof search in a system that will have terminating proof search, so effectively be decidable. So you're basically just running an algorithm that tells you, well, this formula isn't valid. And,
Yes, I can we skip.
Yeah, the aside can be skipped. There's something that I wouldn't want to be skipped, but which hasn't made it here, which would be the comparatively small task of actually drawing a model that you get out of the proof. I mean, once you have the proof, I will adapt this accordingly. So, I mean, there should be, just for instructive reasons, a drawing of the model that you get out of the proof. I mean, the model is very small and the proof is very short, so that's not a lot of extra work. And then there's exercise 4. Which shows how this filtration business works in the case of S4. So first it asks you to do, to show that two things fail. First of all, the two filtrations that we've already seen, the least and the greatest filtration, both don't do the job. So meaning that they cannot be used for S4 in the sense that the model that you obtain by filtering using either the greatest or the least filtration will fail to be transitive in general. So you ask to produce two counterexamples, basically, two transitive models that lose transitivity when you apply the least or the greatest filtration. And for the greatest bit, there's a hint. And then, well, not all the news is bad, right? So there's a third bullet point that basically tells you how to define the filtration in such a way that it does work as a modification of the coarsest filtration. So it's not quite the coarsest one, but just slightly below it. And you're asked to prove that this really is a filtration in the case that M is transitive. And you're asked to show that the relation that you get from the filtration is actually transitive. So both these parts aren't really that hard. Okay. Right. Any questions about these exercises? I mean, of course, as far as you're theoretically able to do them now. Okay. Then, all right, so and now for something completely different, right? So we look at the extension of our original sequence system that we introduced for classical propositional logic to cover the full modal logic K. So just for the heck of it, I'll briefly recall the shape of the propositional rules, right? Well, some of them. So here's one rule for negation, right? Well, there's the obvious other one where the negated formula appears to the right hand of the turnstile. then. There is the right rule for AND. Which says that if I can prove that gamma entails phi or delta and gamma entails psi or delta, then gamma entails phi and psi or delta. I'll omit the left rule for AND, and then let's maybe recall the axiom rule, which says that any sequent that contains the same atom on both sides of the turnstile is provable without further assumptions. So let's just list the ones that I've omitted. I've omitted the left rule for AND, the right rule for NOT, and any other one? So we only have two connectives. We have a rule for bottom on the left and on the right as well, right? Okay. And now our modal logic K is just a minor syntactic extension of this classical propositional logic by one additional operator. But the rule that we're going to see for it will look surprisingly different from all the others for the simple reason that the box makes a step in a Kripke frame. So when I see a box here, it talks about phi appearing in a different state. Or in particular, if it says not box phi here, then it talks about a state existing down here which satisfies not psi and, of course, the boxed formula. And all the things that we know locally here, such as, for instance, that this thing here satisfies P and Q, will not survive down here. I mean, the fact that this here satisfies P and Q says nothing about this state here. So everything that we know about this state here is basically embodied in the boxes and, well, the one negated box that we're looking at. So the behavior of the rules will change in that we will no longer carry along the entire context, this gamma and delta here, from the top to the bottom of the rule. So instead, let's just write the rule down. We're going to call it box. There's not going to be any left and right version of it, just one. Like all the other ones, it's going to have a context on both sides of the turnstile in the premise. And it will demand that we have a few boxes on the left-hand side. Well, actually, the n can be zero, so it doesn't demand anything about the boxes. It will allow us to process a few boxes that are on the left of the turnstile. The boxes appear below. No. It assumes that there are... What? No. No, I'm confused. Wait a moment. Yeah, and I had this turn on my head because I was I'm used to thinking about tableau rules where everything's upside down, so sorry. So it starts like this. It starts with no context. And it starts with just an entailment like this one. So I should properly look at my notes. Do they look the same style here? Yes, that's how they look here.
And one only atoms
here? No, not just atoms. These are variables, so formulas. Okay, so we have some formulas to the left of the turnstile, and we have one formula to the right of the turnstile. Then, we're allowed to introduce a round of boxes to everyone on the left-hand side of the turnstile and everybody, well, just the one guy, on the right-hand side of the turnstile. And now comes the context. So we basically allow, well, why do we do that? Well, because we want to, we want the weakening rule to remain admissible, right? So in this case, we just have to do it violently. We just build weakening into the rule. Basically, you can't, essentially the rule says you can't prove this bit. Well, and you, if you feel the urge to weaken the statement, then you're allowed to do it by just adding more stuff to the left and the right of the turnstile. Okay, so that's...
But notice that you cannot put this gamma and delta upstairs. You cannot put them...
Right, so it's illegal to have the gamma and delta upstairs. I mean, if you put it upstairs, then you weaken the premise and the rule will not be sound anymore. Okay, so that's the only thing you change. You add this rule. Let's go and prove something with it.
Version of context, right? So you have to, you have gamma upstairs, then you have to have box gamma.
Yeah, but that doesn't really change the rule, right? I mean, it's just more notation. Yeah. Yeah, one can do that. So let's look at this formula, for instance, which is one half of one way to phrase the so-called K axiom, which would appear, we haven't done this here and we will not do it, in so-called Hilbert-style axiomatizations of K, as we've seen in the co-algebraic logic seminar. So basically, a Hilbert-style axiomatization would be one that doesn't have so many rules, but which instead just has a lot of axioms, and then two rules to go with it. A necessitation rule, which would be this one, or well, it's right phi here generally, and a simple modest ponens rule that will allow us to actually use implications like this one. Okay, so let's try and prove this formula. I'll now start using the rules upside down, right? So in order to avoid having to estimate on which part of the bottom of the board I have to start, right? So everything's turned upside down now. So, okay, what do I do? First, I decode this, right? So that I'll do on the spot. So this here is the decoding of that implication. And of course, I want to prove it, that is, I put it to the right of the turnstile. Okay, so the right negation rule will allow me to shift this to the left, right? So I get the non-negated formula to the left of the turnstile. Next, I use and left, which, strictly speaking, two times, which means I just dissolve the conjunction signs and I get box A, box B, and not box A and B. Okay. Now I cannot yet apply the rule. I'm almost down to the boxes, but I need a very special format to apply this rule backwards, I need precisely one box to the right of the turnstile. Well, to which I apply the rule, there can be other boxes, but those would be in the context delta, right? So I apply my left negation rule, I get box A, box B on the left of the turnstile and box A and B on the right. This already shows that the propositional formulas, the propositional rules allow me a lot of maneuvering room to basically massage my sequent in such a way that I will actually be able to apply this rule there, although it has this very special shape regarding the position of the boxes. Now comes my box rule. Okay, I happen to not have any context here, right? So gamma and delta are both empty. So going backwards, the box rule just tells me I can remove lots of boxes. So now I arrive at this sequent here, and I won't bother actually proving this sequent, which is clearly valid. And that is it, right? So that proves my formula.
In the classical propositional logic part, at some point, was there a rule for replication derived as exercise or?
We did do that, right? So I could have saved some maneuvering by just applying the implication rule. That's true. I will do that in the future. And actually, you're allowed to do it on the sheet as well, if you wish. Right. So that was a successful proof, and now we try something that shouldn't work. The same thing for the diamond, right? So this intuitively shouldn't be true. Just because there's a successor satisfying A and there's a successor satisfying B, there need not be a successor satisfying both A and B, because these two guys can be different. So let's try and see what happens in the proof. So now, yes, I need to decode this, I'm afraid. So because I don't yet want to spoil the rule there by introducing a diamond rule. So, this is okay, it looks ugly as this, right? So, I replaced every diamond with not box not. And just to make some progress, I'll put it to the right of the turnstile. Okay, so now, given the implication rule that you probably derived from the sheet, this implication sign is just dissolved by putting what's to the left of it to the left of the turnstile. So this becomes okay, and I'll be slightly faster now, so I get a conjunction here, right? So because this is, of course, bracketed like this, I get a conjunction here, which I'm going to dissolve immediately. And I'm here. So I'll just write comments on what connectives I processed to the left of the rule application. So here I'll just process lots of negations, right? I have negation here, negation here, and negation here, and I'll just swap things around according to the negation rules. This gives me box not A and B on the left, and these two guys on the right, so box not A and box not B. Okay, and now I have two ways to apply this box rule. I can pick one box to actually process, and I can put the other one into the context, which, given the way this rule works, just means I toss it. So let's try this one. This would be by the box rule. Not A and B entails not A. Well, I'll stop the proof search here, right? This is evidently not going to be provable because it's not a valid sequence. I can make A true and B false, then this will be true and this will be false, right? So no sense doing further search here. Right, this is the building where they don't trust students with colored chalk, right? Okay. So let's instead pick these two guys. Then we get, by another application of the box rule as an alternative way to complete the proof, that not A and B entails not B. Ah, no point in trying that either, right? Well, let's maybe try it. What happens? Well, we get this, right? And here, of course, we get this. So this makes it easier to see the refuting valuation, right? Here, here we make A true and B false. Here we make B true and A false. Okay, so what we see here is a failed attempt to prove our target sequent, and it's by exhaustive proof search. So basically, I have now shown that all the chances that I have to apply my rule fail, or apply my rules fail. And actually, I can now see a model, more or less. Yeah, it's sort of hidden under this thing. It would be easier to make it visible with some colored chalk. So basically, I have arrived here, and I started applying my modal rules. So we'll discuss a model construction, which will consist in looking at precisely those places where we start applying the modal rule, pick out this guy here, I'll make a fat dot here, it pictures this thing as being red, right, written in red chalk. Okay, so this is one point in the model. Okay, then we arrive here, and down here, well, after some processing, we see the refuting valuation. So this is another fat dot, which is another point in the model, and this here is my last fat dot, another point in the model. And because this one here descends from this one by a modal rule application, backwards, right? So notice how I'm the whole proof search works backwards, right? I start at the intended conclusion and then I try to apply rules backwards. So because this here descends from this one by backwards rule application, I write an arrow here and an arrow here. And so here I write just A, right? Because this here makes A true and it doesn't make B true, and correspondingly here's B. Here there's nothing, right? So because no atoms are mentioned in the sequent here. And okay, there's my counter model, right? It has a root. It has two arrows going out of the root, one into a state satisfying A, one into a state satisfying B. And that's precisely a counter model for this thing, right? Yeah, I satisfy diamond A along this path here. I satisfy diamond B along this one. But I don't satisfy diamond A and B because these are the only two successors and there's no successor that satisfies both A and B. Okay. So we'll make that formal next time. For now, I'll just try and convince you that the rule is sound, right? You should not lose that out of sight entirely. So, I mean, soundness may be sort of trivial, but then if it's trivial, it's exactly the right thing to do when we have 5 minutes left. So Gamma, soundness. I'll say that box is sound, real box is sound. Okay, how do I do that? Have we introduced this notation? No. Well, then I'll not introduce it now. I'll just say, let this sequence be valid. Of course, now valid as a modal sequence, right? So as an implication from a conjunction of the phi 1 up to phi n 2, well, the disjunction of the things on the right, so there's only one thing, so it's just psi. Okay, and then we have to prove that this sequence down here is valid as well. Of course, I can disregard the junk that I put in the context, right? So just to save on some notation, I'll just prove that the essential part here in the middle is valid. Clearly, if that is valid, then it remains valid if I add the gamma and delta.
Wouldn't it be hygienic to say what it means to write a precise definition of what it means for a sequence to be valid in 3D models? Because so far we're only talking about it in CTL case.
Have we said what it means for a formula to be valid? Yes.
Yes.
So. So what it means for a sequence to be valid is to translate it into a formula in the way we always do, conjunction on the left, disjunction on the right, implication in the middle, and to say that this is a valid formula. Okay, and we show that this sequence here is valid. So to show that that sequence is valid, again, amounts to showing that some implication is valid. So we just assume that we have a state satisfying the things on the left, right? So that means we have a model and a state. Satisfying all the boxed formulas on the left, box phi I, where phi goes from 1 to n. We have to show that it also satisfies box psi. Okay, so now we just look at the semantics, right? So show that it satisfies box psi amounts to showing that all its successors satisfy psi. So we give ourselves a successor. So we assume that we have V such that W is in relation R to V. Well, I haven't bothered to reintroduce all the notation for the parts of M, so R, of course, is supposed to be the transition relation of M. Okay. We have to show that V satisfies psi. Well, V is an R successor of W, and W satisfies box phi I for every I. So, we have that V satisfies phi I for I being anything from 1 to n by the semantics of the box and the fact that W satisfies box phi I. And therefore, because this is a valid sequent, we have that m, v also satisfies psi. Right, because our original sequent from the premise of the rule is valid. And that's it. So the rule is sound. Right, so we're going to prove next time that the system is complete, and we're going to look at a variant of the system that will work for S4 in place of K. A, in order to enable you to solve the exercises, and B, because S4 is going to be an important logic for the next chapter where we start on intuitionistic logic, because it will turn out that intuitionistic logic is essentially a sublogic of S4. Okay. One thing to think about already now is, when I look at this proof system here, will proof search terminate? I mean, we've seen that it terminated in the example that I gave, yes. Will it always terminate? So one has to be careful because appearances can be deceiving. This n might actually be zero. So the fact that all these boxes here disappear actually says nothing, but this box here disappears in any application of the rule. Of course, this just means that this branch here terminates, right? So when I try to prove this sequent here by focusing on this box and applying the rule to it, that branch will terminate. So strictly speaking, I also have to think not only about how deep the branches of my proof search can be, but also how many branches there are. But it's clear I can apply this rule, well, in principle, in exponentially many ways on the left by picking any subset of the boxes on the left-hand side, times linearly many ways on the right by picking one of the boxes that I have on the right-hand side. But of course, the exponential dependence on the left-hand side is a total red herring, because one can very easily convince oneself that if any rule application with a particular box on the right-hand side is successful, then also the one where I pick all boxes from the left-hand side will be successful, because this gives me the weakest sequent to prove here, the one with the most formulas to the left-hand of the turnstile. So there's only linearly many instances of the rule to try for any given sequent, right? So I'm finitely branching. The branches have finite depth. And in fact, this already goes to show that there's a space bound on this thing. I'll discuss this in more detail next time. Maybe you can briefly think about how much space an implementation of this proof search would use. Okay, so see you tomorrow. Thank you.